RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Alrighty then. Michael Nevridakis, PhD, is a senior reporter for The Defender and part of the rotation of hosts for Children's Health Defence TV's Good Morning CHD. He's based in Athens, Greece. For 10 years, he produced and hosted the Dialogos radio program and podcast, and he's previously been published by The Guardian, The Huffington Post, The Daily Kos, Truthout, Mint Press News, among others. And he's been reporting on the Pact for the Future. If you're listening yesterday, you would have heard that the UN Pact for the Future was adopted. We thought we'd get Michael on this morning on RCR to take us through it, what he thinks it means, what we need to think about, the major points, etc., etc. Michael Nevridakis, welcome to our program. Thanks for joining us all the way from Athens, Greece.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be on.
Okay, so yesterday we heard the news, we carried it here, that the UN Pact for the Future was adopted. Folks, if you haven't caught up with the news, world leaders met in New York over the weekend at the 79th UN General Assembly to discuss the Pact for the Future, which was adopted, which includes proposals for global digital ID and online censorship. Critics have been warning the pact may give the UN Secretary General unprecedented emergency powers and erode personal freedom and national sovereignty. So, Michael, there was no question this UN Pact for the Future was always going to be adopted, right?
There's definitely no question about it. They've been talking about it for quite a number of years, even going before COVID. COVID really sped up the process because it gave them that sort of global emergency that they were looking for to point to and say, look, we need, you know, these global powers. We need this level of global coordination to be able to respond to the next global emergency. So I think it's indicative that if you look at what happened over the past couple of days with the UN adopting the Pact for the Future, it was adopted without a vote. They didn't even bother to go through the formalities of having the UN member states voting on it. So this was a done deal even before the General Assembly began.
So that was kind of theater. The last bit of the theater, the last act, was it, that we had over the weekend there?
I think you could say that. I mean, you know, the UN and the whole ecosystem that surrounds the UN always talks about things like inclusion and democracy, and they like to use all of these buzzwords. But when you actually look at the processes they follow, and we can name other examples of this as well, such as, for instance, the international health amendments that the World Health Organization, which is an arm of the UN, so they're a UN organization, these sorts of things are passed without votes. They have other processes in place that not only bypass the actual voting procedure, but they also make it very difficult for member states that may, for whatever reason, actually object some level to what's going on to voice those objections. And even if they do manage to voice an objection, it's usually shouted down. So there isn't really much of a process there to debate openly what is being adopted or what is being considered for adoption.
There seems to be a feel of catastrophization. Is that the word here? Like there are catastrophes just around the corner all the time when kind of there weren't before COVID. So this is opportunistic, is it? This is a sort of an opportunistic move based on that.
It absolutely is. That's why I was saying a moment ago that COVID really was the global emergency, quote unquote, that really spurred all of these initiatives, whether we're talking about the Pact for the Future and everything that goes along with that, and I know we'll talk more about it, or something like the pandemic treaty that they're still negotiating and they're trying to get it done either by the end of this year or by the next World Health Assembly, which will be May 2025 in Geneva, or the international health amendments that were passed this year and a different set that was passed a year or two ago. They always point to not just to emergencies that have occurred, but also, you know, vague warnings of emergencies that may follow. It was Tedros, the Director General of the World Health Assembly, who was warning at the World Economic Forum back in January in Davos that the pandemic treaty, for instance, is needed because the next pandemic is literally around the corner. It's not a question of if it will happen. It's a question of when it will happen. So they're doing the same thing here with the Pact for the Future. There's an article that I wrote last year for The Defender when, you know, this was still kind of something that was in the background. Not many people knew that this was being talked about outside of UN circles. What does, you know, the UN define as these global emergencies, or they call them global shocks? Well, pandemics, the threat of there being another pandemic is one, but they also list, for instance, climate. So they could basically insert anything into this category of, you know, being a so-called climate emergency. Biological warfare, that's another warning. That's another sort of category that they're warning about. Supply chain disruptions, which, you know, we've been seeing that over the last few years, and we're blaming COVID for it, you know, for people not being able, you know, to go to a supermarket and find full shelves. Cyberspace disruptions, and, you know, aka, you know, something happening to the internet, the internet going down, yep. A quote unquote event, yep, in outer space. You know, what kind of event might that be? They're not really too clear on it. And then even less clear than that is what they call an unforeseen black swan event. Well, what's a black swan event? It's really just something really awful and terrible that it can't even be imagined right now. So they kind of just have this catch-all, yep, category, which, you know, catch-all categories are dangerous because anything can then be defined as this sort of unforeseen event. So all of these are the global shocks that they're not just warning about, but the point here is that the Pact for the Future does more than just warn. The idea is that the UN Secretary General, whoever, you know, the current one or any future one, could be given by the UN emergency powers to respond to any of these potential future global shocks. And these emergency powers are also rather vague. There's some lip service there in a document that says, oh, you know, these emergency powers shouldn't be permanent and we should be careful in making sure that they're not abused. But the language is vague. And if you look at the details, it allows those powers to be renewed. And it's unprecedented. The UN Secretary General has never had these emergency powers. And the idea is to then get nations together and coordinate them to respond, of course, to these global shocks. So the final thing I'll say about this is that, you know, in the announcements and the news articles that have come out ever since the Pact for the Future was approved, on the one hand, you read that there's an Al Jazeera story that says that the Pact for the Future is non-binding, right? So it sounds like, oh, this is not that much different from like a UN resolution or something along those lines. But then you see some countries, and you know, they name Russia because Russia is, it's easy to point to Russia as the bogeyman that's kind of like trying to disrupt what the international community is doing. Yeah. They issued an amendment basically emphasizing the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of state. So they're basically saying, you know, let's add this amendment, just promising that the UN is not going to interfere internally, as in, you know, domestic governments and domestic governance. And it was overwhelmingly dismissed, according to Al Jazeera. So,
wow,
they dismissed, okay, this. You know, if the intent is not to interfere internally, why dismiss this resolution? No matter who's proposing it, could be Russia, it could be China, it could be the U.S. And then the final thing is, you then go to the official UN press release about this, and one of the things that it says, regarding digital cooperation, and I know we can talk more about that, but they're requiring, that's a word that they use, requiring countries to take concrete actions by 2030. So that's very definite language. That doesn't sound very non-binding to me.
It sounds like the architecture for some kind of global control, potentially. Is that too far out there? That's what it sounds like.
I don't think it isn't, because if you're talking about giving the head of the UN, the Secretary General, emergency powers that position, the Secretary General, has not had before, suddenly you're talking about someone that will have this global, not just coordinating role, even though that's already an enormous power, but, you know, the UN will declare these emergencies. The UN will then get member states to take action on these emergencies. And despite all of this rhetoric that it's non-binding, when you see official UN documents then saying that countries will be required to take concrete actions on things like digital cooperation, for instance, by 2030, which of course is also the target year for the implementation of the global UN Sustainable Development Goals, then, you know, it really does come off as a power grab, just as the pandemic treaty that they're negotiating comes across as that as well.
Do the two go together? Do you think?
I would say that they do. The pandemic treaty goes into more details, essentially, about one of these global shocks that they're warning about. And I'll go back to what Tedros, the head of the WHO, was saying in January at the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos. He was really sort of pressing the representatives of nation states that were there to get the negotiations on this pandemic treaty completed, because he was saying there's no time. We have to do this. We have to do this now, because, again, it's not a question of if there might be a new pandemic. It's a question of when that will be. Of course, Tedros made similar remarks last year, 2023, at the World Health Assembly, and that was when they also voted themselves a budget increase. So there's a lot of money also that sloshes around. That money sloshes around because the impetus for it is the fact that they point at these emergencies. They say, you know, they need to be prepared to respond to them. So it's a very lucrative venture for them. In addition to, of course, also being something that gives them a lot of power that they have not had previously.
What is the out of space event? I'm just been thinking about that since you mentioned it, and I knew it was in there. What is that? I mean, is that like meteor strike or alien invasion? I mean, what the hell is that?
I think we can just use our imagination. They don't go into, at least as far as I've seen, and there's so many documents. By the way, going through these things, it's like going through a labyrinth, and it's very much intentional because they don't want lay people, you know, quote unquote, they don't want investigative or independent journalists going through these documents very easily. But there's not really anything I've seen that gives a clear definition as what these outer space events might be. We could use our imagination. So it could be anything from alien invasion to some sort of meteor collision to, I think one specific phrase I did see in some documents was sort of an arms race in outer space. Like they're warning that powerful countries or like bad actors are going to launch technology into outer space and then threaten humanity with it. So, which sounds, you know, very far-fetched considering who are the few actors that have access to outer space. They made sure to include this sort of outer space event as one of the possible global shocks that may come in the future. So I don't think including this or anything else that was on that list is something that happened by chance, let's say.
None of this has been reported apart from our radio station reporting it. And there might be one or two lines, I haven't looked yet, in some of our mainstream media outlets about it being adopted, but I'm picking no detail at all. No citizen has been consulted on this here, yet we are being signed up for pretty incredible stuff, aren't we? Without even our knowledge, and it could be incredibly far-reaching. It could restrict our freedoms, our movement around the planet. I take it it's like that everywhere else as well, that really there's been no informing the citizenry, no negotiation about it, no referendums, nothing. It's just gone through. What does that say about, well, I guess our government or UN representation and everybody else's? Where are their heads at, Michael, do you think?
Well, they like to keep these sorts of votes. Well, this wasn't really a vote, but all of these sorts of proposals as not, you know, as secret as possible without actually being secret. They're kind of like a hidden in plain sight. That's the phrase I was looking for. So they do this in many ways. They make sure that the media coverage of it is very limited, and to the extent that there might be a mainstream media outlet that writes about the Pact for the Future being adopted, the articles are very vague and don't go into a lot of detail. There's, of course, no parliamentary debate that I know of in any country. And if there is in some country somewhere, you know, we're talking about a very small number, a very small percentage out of the, you know, the overall number of nation states around the world. So our elected officials, our representatives are making sure that the public is not being made aware of this, and they're not debating this in a public forum like a national parliament or in Congress or anything like that. The documents themselves are labyrinthine and just really hard to navigate. They're written in this very dense bureaucratic jargon that if you're not someone that is used to looking at these documents, let's say, or, you know, has, you know, really studied them for quite a while. I'm not saying this to make myself look smart. I'm just saying, you know, they write them in such a way that they use language that means something to them, but not necessarily to the general public. And then, you know, you mentioned citizens didn't have a say. They like using the word stakeholders. That's one of the
What does that mean, Michael? What does stakeholders actually mean? I've always wanted to get the true definition of that.
Exactly what I was getting at. But what is a stakeholder? They refer to private actors. They refer to academic institutions. They refer to NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And, you know, it's not, you know, your local neighborhood food bank. That's the NGO that's a stakeholder at the UN. We're talking about massive organizations like Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, which was, you know, one of the founders was the Gates Foundation, and Gates has representatives, or the Gates Foundation has representatives on Gavi's board to this day, and they pushed the global, they were part of the global push for the COVID jabs to be distributed, you know, with equity, you know, that's another one of their buzzwords, to poorer countries. You know, don't leave the poor behind. Make sure they get the jabs as well. So those are the types of entities that they consider stakeholders. If you look at any reference to stakeholders in any of these UN documents, ordinary citizens are never included on that list. It's always these official organizations that are included. So they're the ones that have this quote unquote seat at the table. There's this UN document that I've referred to in some of my stories for The Defender. It comes from the World Health Organization. I imagine that there might be other similar documents for other organizations that are affiliated with the UN. This document comes from 2022 when they were talking about developing an agreement or some type of instrument, yet another one of these buzzwords, on pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. Well, you know, who were the stakeholders that were listed in this document? Gavi is one of them. The Vatican is listed as one of them.
The Vatican, right.
The Africa CDC, the Council of Europe. There's the International Monetary Fund, which, you know, a lot of people in a lot of countries, including where I am in Greece, are very familiar with the International Monetary Fund and what they actually have done to those countries. So you just go on down the list and you see all of these institutions and centers, and these are all groups, or a lot of them, but these are groups that are all, you know, if one starts digging, they're probably all interconnected to each other in some way, giving research grants to each other or receiving grants and funding from the same sources, like the Gates, for instance. And they're the ones that are, you know, the stakeholders, according to the UN, according to the WHO, according to all of these types of agencies.
Yeah, the Vatican is kind of the odd one out there. I'm wondering why they are a stakeholder. I mean, what, Acts of God? That's a different department for them. I don't know why they're in there.
We can only guess as to why they might be in there. And the, also Open Society, they're in there. They're listed.
Yeah, that's Soros,
so George Soros. So, yeah, these are the types of groups that are in there. And we're talking about, you know, very powerful groups. We're talking about NGOs that have huge budgets. We're not talking about, again, you know, your little local community groups. They don't have a seat at the table. It's these large organizations that do.
And it's interesting when you mentioned before that, you know, Russia's deputy of foreign affairs, Sergei Vershinin, introduced that amendment, which is a logical amendment to the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of states. I thought that was a bedrock thing. And it's dismissed. It's voted down. So that maybe tells you a lot. Now, I want to get into what the Pact for the Future includes. Global Digital Compact. You mentioned, what was it, Global Cooperation, I think. So this is so, what, everyone can keep track of everybody else. If we boil it down, is that what it means, do you think?
I think if you boil it down, that's certainly one of the meanings. If you look at the Global Digital Compact, then there's also something else that's part of the Pact for the Future. It's a, it's what they call a proposal on information integrity. It's very similar because they're both referring to the internet and digital communication and so forth. A lot of what they talk about in these documents is the so-called digital divide. And, you know, to a certain extent, there is such a thing as a digital divide because there's many ways you can define what the digital divide is. I mean, you know, not everyone is online. Not everyone is equally, let's say, fluent in using new technologies. And of course, now they're adding AI to that list, artificial intelligence. In different countries, there's different sort of percentages of people that have access to this technology. So, you know, at face value, a lot of things that the UN talks about at face value sound very good, right? You know, make sure that poorer people don't fall behind with, you know, technologies that, you know, children will need to be able to get ahead in their futures and so on. Well, you know, one, however, you know, if one sort of thinks about this a little bit more critically, why is there such a push for the UN, for instance, for all of these sorts of actors to make sure that, like, everyone gets online by, let's say, 2030, which is the sort of like the target here they throw about for a lot of these initiatives? Well, if we sort of then begin to connect it to something like digital ID, for instance, digital, you know, or digital identity, proposals for that are all over the sustainable development goals, for instance, and they sort of couch it in these sorts of terms that no one should be left behind, people having access to the internet and having digital ID to sort of prove who they are will open up economic opportunities for them. They never talk about why these people don't have these economic opportunities now without digital ID, right, for instance, why they suddenly, you know, need to go from being, you know, starving and suffering to walking around with a smartphone with their credentials on it. It seems like, you know,
and still you think
there would be other priorities to help these people, right? So that's a lot of what they talk about. And then peppered throughout these documents are references to misinformation, disinformation, and doing something about it. They never really get too specific as to what that might be. There was this one phrase that I found that I'm looking for in my notes. That was sort of essentially saying that information that's online needs to reflect the scientific consensus. Well, what's the scientific consensus? Yeah. Who defines that? They didn't define it. There was no definition for what that consensus is.
It doesn't exist. I've talked to scientists, and you mentioned that, and they said that's not even a thing.
It's not
science is not about consensus at all.
That's not what science is about. Right, yeah. Right. So that's what they're talking about. So obviously the idea then is to not just promote one sort of favored narrative, whatever issue might be in question, but also to very actively go after those narratives that contradict or question that favored narrative. So that's kind of reading I won't say reading between the lines, but because they never really go into too much detail, you have to pick up on a phrase here, a phrase there, and sort of put it together like a puzzle to sort of see what they're getting at. So that's what they seem to be getting at with this digital compact and with this proposal for so-called information integrity.
So they want as many people, doesn't matter where you are in the world, how poor you are, how wealthy you are, whatever, ID digitally, and to police some kind of definition of mis and disinformation at the same time, sounding like we're creeping toward, I hate to say it again, like a one world control. You can kind of see how it's forming up. And I don't want to sound like overblown, but what else could it be? What else could it be?
Well, again, you know, putting all the puzzle pieces together, if you're talking about giving the UN Secretary General these unprecedented emergency powers, and then in the same set of documents, you're also saying that there needs to be something done about misinformation and disinformation, and the, you know, the facts that reflect the scientific consensus need to be bolstered online. Well, that tells you that anytime there's this global shock or global emergency, they'll come out with a narrative, and then anything that is not part of that narrative will be defined as misinformation and disinformation. We saw this already with COVID. It sounds like they're now sort of putting this into formal practice, what they were kind of doing without having a pact for the future in place up until now.
Then there's the declaration on future generations. What does that actually mean, do you think?
So this declaration, and again, other documents that are also part of this labyrinth, makes a lot of references to the future of education as they imagine it and as they imagine it should be. I would say the what comes up more than anything from what I've seen in these documents is artificial intelligence, AI. There's this talk about harnessing the potential powers and benefits of AI for good, for the good of humanity, and of course for the good of the future generations, including, you know, students, school children. So finding ways to get AI into the classroom, but in these sort of very nice ways. So as I was looking at all of these documents, what I remembered was I wrote a story about 2 years ago for The Defender about the World Economic Forum. They like to write these papers about how they imagine a future will be like or how it should be like according to, you know, their point of view. And this document was gushing over how it's really a great thing to microchip children. But beyond that, as terrible as that is, they were basically imagining AI classrooms where there would still be actual, in the flesh, real human teachers, but they would have a very different role from what we know from the role that teachers have today. They would be kind of in a more supportive role. So AI will be kind of like the driver of education, and then teachers will be there in the secondary capacity to augment what AI is already doing in the classroom. And the classroom, there might be a physical classroom that students would sort of show up at for a few hours, but the document was sort of getting at the classroom would be all day, basically, through these immersive technologies, through augmented reality, through virtual reality, and of course, just through being online or in the metaverse. So that's essentially how they imagine the future of education to be. Now, why am I referring to a WEF document? Well, we've already seen that the WEF and the UN are very much aligned on all sorts of goals. They're very much aligned on the sustainable development goals. We had Tedros from the World Health Organization, and of course we've had Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, speak at Davos at these WEF events. So they're very closely linked. So when the WEF writes these position papers on what they imagine the world could or should be like in the future, it's hard to imagine that the UN views things much differently. And then if you go back to this, to these documents that are part of the Pact for the Future, when you see references again and again and again to AI and AI in the classroom and AI in schools and making sure that future students all learn about, how to navigate these technologies, we see that, again, it's very similar to what the WF has been saying for years.
Wow. Okay, so the obvious question is, who's at the top of the tree here, do you think? Who's really driving this? WEF, UN, the NGOs that you mentioned, the WHOs in there. Where is the top that it's coming down from, do you think?
I have to imagine. I mean, I can't point to any document that proves this. I just have to imagine, though, that there's certain entities that just carry a lot more weight than some others. And I would imagine that some of those entities are these groups like Gavi that have backers like Bill Gates and other billionaire so-called philanthropists that are supporting them. I have to imagine that it's certain national governments and very large sort of like supranational governmental entities, whether it's like the European Union or NATO or the International Monetary Fund, global banks, who, of course, you know, are very much aligned with groups like the IMF. I have to imagine that they're the ones that are at the top of the totem pole, so to speak, because, you know, circumstantially, if you look at what groups like Gavi, like the Gates Foundation, like the Open Society Foundation, what they write about all the time, it's very much similar to what the UN is saying in these documents, like the Pact for the Future. We had Bill Gates recently, for instance, give these interviews on U.S. media. He was in CNBC and some others talking about, oh, well, you know, free speech is very nice and all. I'm all for it, except I'm not all for it because people use that speech to say terrible things like questioning vaccines. So, so he went on to attack what he was calling misinformation, disinformation, and we see that very same attack in the Pact for the Future document. So I think we see this alignment between what billionaires like Gates want and what the UN then comes out and enacts without a vote, so that, you know, it's not too far-fetched to imagine that people like Gates, like Soros, who have a lot of money and a lot of influence over media, over different governments, are really pulling the strings here.
Critics argue the public needs to remain vigilant, obviously, warning the pact may turn into a binding international treaty under the Vienna Convention. Have you got anything to say about that? Because it's non-binding right now, correct?
So my understanding of it, you know, I spoke to Francis Boyle. He's an international law professor at the University of Illinois. He's one of the top experts on how these international agreements become binding, how they sort of become how they become binding domestic law in many countries and get basically the status of an international treaty. So what Boyle seems to be saying is that now that we have the passage of the Pact for the Future, now we might see various governments, various parliaments around the world come back, bring these documents into parliament, or some of them might even just go through their Ministry of Foreign Affairs or their State Department or something like that, and get this, get the Pact for the Future essentially recognized as part of their customary domestic law in one form or another. They may add it, for instance, to their book of treaties that they are signatories to. And once that happens, it's the same as any other international treaty. So we're talking about something that the UN is sort of going through a lot of effort to tell us right now is non-binding. But once governments begin to enact language that is essentially a parallel with, you know, the Pact for the Future, right? Or begin to pass legislation that uses, that specifically refers to the Pact for the Future as sort of a guiding document, for instance, to to what is guiding that legislation, then essentially we're talking about something that's not binding anymore. It reminds me very much of how the European Union operates. They come out with these directives, as they call them, that are not debated by anyone that's actually been elected by any voter anywhere. And then they're passed, and then they kind of just get sent to the member states, and they're expected to pass legislation, domestic versions of legislation that essentially reflect that directive. So Boyle is saying that through a very similar process, we may see this quote-unquote non-binding Pact for the Future become binding in a sense that there will be laws in place in different parts of the world and documents recognizing that this is an international document that has the power or the equivalent power to a treaty.
Before time's up on us, Michael, I'm going to ask you about, because I think you've written about our COVID inquiry here. And I just wonder, from half a world away, the view you have of that. You've got any comments to make about what we're about? Well, we've had the first one, and that was kind of the one you have when you're not having one. And we've got our phase two coming up, which is broad in terms of reference. We've fought hard for that and could uncover a lot of stuff. So what's your view from where you are of what we're about to do here?
Well, I did write that story about a week or so ago for The Defender. I spoke to Barry Young, the well-known whistleblower. I spoke to an attorney from Australia that has worked a lot with groups and individuals in New Zealand. My reaction, first of all, is that what I read about the especially the first stage of the COVID inquiry in New Zealand, it's not much different from what I've read about the few other countries, including the UK, where there have been similar inquiries, and they all kind of seem to follow the same sort of script. They go out and talk to a lot of people that have, let's say, been, they say that these are people that have been impacted by COVID and a government response to it. But what do they mean by that? They're not going out and talking to people that were injured by the jabs. They're not going out and talking to family members of people who were killed by the jabs or by hospital protocols, which is something I wrote about for The Defender more recently, giving people that supposedly had COVID, that's what they diagnosed them with. They may have gone to the hospital just with cold symptoms, giving them like remdesivir and putting them on ventilators until they finally died. They're not talking to those sorts of people. They're talking up to like nurses that are saying, oh, we didn't have enough masks and PPE in the hospitals early on. So they're using that to kind of justify an even stronger sort of similar response in the future. That's my reading of it, at least. If they're speaking to people that were saying, oh, we needed to have done more and certain things did work out, it was good that we had these lockdowns because they helped to stop the spread and so on. That's essentially what I'm coming away with from these few national inquiries that I am aware of that are in progress, whether it's in the UK or New Zealand. They're also taking an enormous amount of time. And even in the second phase of the New Zealand inquiry, one thing that I was told, and then I saw this in writing as well, is that even that stage of the inquiry, it's certainly expanded compared to the first phase, but it does not include as part of the topic areas, essentially, that are going to be investigated, anything that has to do with vaccine harms, as far as I saw. So that's still not part of the, not going to be part of the second phase, as far as I can see. And again, very similar to what's going on.
Well there is vaccine safety. So some are thinking that that category or that heading might cover that. But yeah, it's not definitively worded.
It isn't. So these are terminologies that they use that are very easy to define in very different ways. So I'm just looking for the language that was kind of left out of the phase two document. But there was something over there. I think it had to do with vaccine injuries. There's something there that's missing. And there's something there that's missing that is very important and that would be sort of a game changer if it was to be included in the inquiry. So I think the point over here is more and more people are coming out and speaking out about their experiences in terms of having been injured by these shots or having lost their loved ones because of these shots. More and more documents have come out about the safety of these shots. And if an inquiry doesn't fully begin to not just recognize these voices, but actually investigate what all of these studies have begun to show over things like, you know, the DNA contamination in the COVID shots, then we're talking about an incomplete inquiry. And we're talking about sort of just ensuring that in the future, maybe with some variations, if there's another so-called health emergency, the response will be similar, at the very least.
Michael Nevridakis, senior reporter for The Defender. You can see Michael's work, or some of it anyway, at childrenshealthdefence.org. Thank you for coming on our program and taking us through those things. Really interesting. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Paul, thank you. It was a pleasure. Happy to be on anytime.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.